The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi. The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. With lightning fast speeds rolling out to a million homes.
Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so to this week, I spoke to Professor of Film Studies and Screen Culture in UCD, Diane Negra, about how celebrity culture has been weakened by the pandemic. Counselor and therapist Brian Sinnott from Tig Lynn was on the phone to talk to me about the term dry drunk and the challenges of living with a recovering addict. The last Nazi hunter, Dr. Ephraim Zuroff, told me about his mission to track down the last surviving Nazis from the Holocaust. Aileen Rogers and Trasa Cameron spoke to me about the incredible life story of John Cameron, who at only 5 months old was abandoned in a Dublin orphanage. And I chat to Ashley Casserly, the Irish woman who became an unlikely reality TV star on Zombie House Flipping. She tells me about life in Orlando and how a role on the reality TV show came about. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy. In the course of meeting two men who I've admired since I was young watching TV, one is Michael Parkinson and the other is Terry Wogan. And in the course of my chats with both, Michael Parkinson often said that towards the end of his interviewing career, he found that celebrities were so vacuous, that had so little to say, that he found his job a little boring. Because he remembered talking to people like James Stewart, who would have fought in World War II and who had a massive array of stories to tell because he had a life beyond the camera. And Terry Wogan said towards the end of his television career as a presenter particularly, he knew he was kind of out when Bette Davis, as a very old lady, came on and halfway during the interview slapped him and said, "When are you going to talk to me about my book?" And he thought, I want to talk to you a bit more about than just flogging your book sort of thing. And it was striking because I'm going to talk to Professor Diane Negra about this whole area of when celebrity stops becoming important and becomes kind of vacuous and the effect COVID has had on that whole world. Diane, good morning to you. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning.
Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on this whole area of celebrity culture and COVID. What is the connection you've drawn between the two?
Well, I think COVID has had an unexpected event on the sort of effect on the celebrity ecosystem, which is to say it hasn't been good for celebrities, if I can put it in that kind of blunt way. And what's really notable is that we haven't seen the emergence of pro-social forms of celebrity. And in the past, crisis moments, crisis periods, have tended to be kind of good for celebrity. You alluded to World War II. You could think about Vietnam, even 9/11 in a certain way kind of had that effect. But in the pandemic, it's proven very difficult for celebrities to connect with people. And there's been a kind of crisis of relatability, I think.
Brilliant. Everything you've just said makes great sense. So let's break it all down. I should say that you're the professor of film studies in UCD. So that gives us a bit of context in terms of why you're talking about Hollywood and celebrities, broadly speaking. But you mentioned World War II, you mentioned Vietnam, and I mentioned James Stewart. We could talk about Jane Fonda and in terms of a celebrity taking a stance on a big issue of the day. Did people in those circumstances welcome the celebrity endorsement or denial of a certain view?
Right. Well, I think certainly in previous decades, there was a sense that part of what a kind of classical Hollywood celebrity was supposed to do was to sort of be pro-social, is to be seen and to be involved in charitable endeavors, things of that sort. There's a long history of this going on. But early in the pandemic, when Gal Gadot tried to do a video of this Imagine piece, it turned into a fail video and people rejected it. You know, so I think there's a sense that we no longer look to celebrities to function that way, that something's changed in the emotional economy around them, and that admiration has receded, that we don't look to celebrities in that same way as above us. In other words, we don't see them so much as talent displaying as profit seeking. We've come down to a financial level.
Right. That's a great word because the COVID experience for a lot of people has been a leveler. Not everyone. I mean, as they say, the same waters, different crafts. But when you think of the Gal Gadot, which became within probably minutes something that was sneered at and scoffed at, even though I don't think there was any badness in what she was trying to achieve, is there a cynicism that comes with, say, online reaction versus reaction previous to the online phenomenon?
Oh, I think so. And I think one of the things that we've seen in the last, year or so is how dependent the star system still is on Hollywood to deliver us certain kinds of products that we recognize that fit into generic modes and that then kind of unspool a very familiar process of publicity. But that notion of old Hollywood is really on the wane now, and I'm thinking about, you know, one of the last big successes of that kind before the pandemic was, of course, Bradley Cooper's revival of A Star is Born, and you probably remember this kind of electrifying moment at the Oscars when he and Lady Gaga get up and perform, you know, the song from that film, and it's this just fascinating thing. People rose to their feet. They were still applauding on the ad break, and those moments of a kind of older, glamorous, remote, you know, talent-centered celebrity seem to be fading in favor of influencer culture and other more mundane modes of celebrity.
So can we try and, I mean, in your research or your studies of it all, and it's all because COVID's still a fluent story.
Yeah.
Have you discovered, Diane, in any sense, what happened to people? Why did they suddenly go, once upon a time, you were lionized and elevated? You know, who kicked the plinth from under them?
Yeah. Well, I certainly think that the rise of reality TV about 20 or 30 years ago has been a significant milestone. I think that we've also seen a massive rise in tabloid culture, paparazzism. There's been a turn just lately in popular culture toward revisiting the 90s with a sense of horror, for example, looking at how young female celebrities were treated in those years. So my sense is that we've had a couple of different technological generic evolutions, if you want to call them that, tabloidism, paparazzism, and reality TV, but then it's really social media, because social media thrives on the idea that we are all sort of curating ourselves to be celebrities, that this kind of sense that celebrity isn't a remote, far-off thing, and it isn't something for which you pay your dues over many years. When you think about what the Hollywood studios used to do, how they used to groom star properties over a long period of time, the idea of instant celebrity and a celebrity that's based on our desire to be famous seems to now be at the center of things.
So what do we do with compare and contrast, to use the Leaving Cert-ism, of an influencer versus a movie star? You mentioned Bradley Cooper, for example, or Lady Gaga, who's now more and more movie star as much as a singer, versus, say, Marie Kondo or Joe Wicks. I mean, what's the comparative analysis, if you like, of their celebrity and influence?
Well, I think a lot of celebrities now only have niche appeal. There's a term for this, which is micro-celebrity, right?
Okay.
The idea that we no longer, or we have far fewer stars who unify a vast public. We talked at one point, I think, in a prior conversation about Tom Hanks and the fact that in the United States there was this incredible evening on television, March 12th, it was of 2020, when Donald Trump gets on TV and he says flights to Europe are going to be curtailed. He was actually wrong, but he announced this. And at the same time, Tom Hanks announced that he and his wife, Rita Wilson, had COVID. And CNN was in a frenzy. It didn't know which story was more important, and it just bounced between the two of them all evening. But that sense that someone like Tom Hanks, who is an old-school movie star in many respects, could show the country that COVID was going to affect it. You know, he could do that, but a micro-celebrity couldn't, partly because they just don't speak to a kind of broad public in the way old-school movie stars do.
There is a sense of, as you're talking, I'm reflecting on the idea that when celebrities would come on line and say, I've had a bad day, or I'm feeling this way or that way, people go, well, do you know what? There's somebody over there who has a lot worse, a lot worse than you. So you can absolutely beat it with that thought, because you are out of touch, you're out of sync, and you've got this all out of context.
I think that's been a big part of the relatability crisis that I was alluding to before in the pandemic, because when certain celebrities tried to make quarantine videos, they got called out for their luxury quarantining. Jennifer Lopez is an early example of this. And so there's been one effect of the pandemic, which is to, I think, heighten, I'm speaking about the United States in particular, is to heighten a set of class relationships that normally don't get spoken of. And so I think that this kind of crisis that the pandemic represents on so many levels has also become a crisis for the celebrity economy. It's by no means the most important effect of the pandemic.
No.
I'm not suggesting that. But if somebody like me is an academic, if you accept my argument, which is that celebrity is a social phenomenon that we should take seriously, that tells us a lot about how we live, what our values are, what our interests are, then I think these things are important.
We found, because I present a talk, what you would call in America, a talk show in Ireland on a Friday night, and we have found that First of all, everyone wants Irish guests on the programme much more than any other. I don't know if that's just today or this at these days, but I don't think so. I think it was ever thus. But anyway, that's one thing. But certainly since COVID started, even though our show is a mixture of the serious and the light entertainment, when we cover COVID, and certainly at the beginning, the first 6 to 9 months, even the year, the demand from the public for the likes of Tony Houlihan, Luke O'Neill, people like this, they wanted to see them because there was trust and knowledge and explanation. And they became a strangely celebrity element to them.
Yeah, well, the new kind of scientist public authority is definitely a phenomenon that we have here in this country, and it overarches with the U.S. You know, Luke O'Neill, Tony Fauci, people like this. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems to me that they have become the face of the pandemic in various ways, and it's probably not an accident that most of them are older white guys, right? And that they have access to a certain kind of traditional authority that maybe, you know, we revert back to in times of crisis. In a certain way. But yeah, I think what you said is so interesting, because I would draw a distinction between the Irish case and the U.S. case. Mm. I've suggested that in COVID has been very bad for the U.S. kind of celebrity marketplace by and large. But I don't think the same is true of Ireland. And in fact, you know, you could talk about various cases. The Matt Damon case is clearly the headline here. Yeah. But, you know, Adam King, certainly, as you know better than anybody, I think has you know, through the Toy Show, has become that unifying figure. There are other examples that we could point to. I mean, I think that the you know, certainly the Paul Mescal frenzy, which got commodified, you know, the moment when we hear that Paul Mescal is attributing, you know, is contributing to a 20% rise in sales of O'Neill shorts and, you know, this kind of thing. So I think what I'm thinking about a lot just lately in this research, you know, project is that the warning lights that I think celebrity culture is giving in the United States don't seem to be happening in Ireland the same way. And there are multiple cases here of that unifying pro-social celebrity that gives people in a country undergoing extraordinary difficulties a sense of being in something together.
And this person, whether it's, as you say, Adam King, or it's a bit of frippery with the Paul Mescal factor, but also the scientists kind of telling you where to go, are they acting as a salve, or are people just scared, or have you delved that deep into it?
Well, here's the thing I would say. If you go all the way back 100 years ago to the beginning of Hollywood in the silent period, the early studios had no desire or intention to market celebrities. But people wrote into the studios very early. I'm talking about, you know, 1908, very early. Mm-hmm. And they said, who's that woman that I saw in your film? And who is this guy? And the first celebrity is often considered to be a person called Florence Lawrence, not well remembered today. But Biograph, her studio, was really annoyed because people wrote in and said, who is this person? And they kind of had to name her. They wanted to call her the Biograph girl, but over time they had to call her Florence Lawrence. So I think that there is something about, you know, something that about the human nature, that we want personalization and focalization. We want to sort of feel as if we have relationships with people that we don't know. I think that moment, that early unifying moment of 100 years ago, is now flipped around, and we're seeing kind of the reverse, that the niche celebrity landscape is so kind of fractured and broken down that it's showing us in some ways how imperiled, you might say, U.S. democracy is at this moment, how different the United States is, for example, than it was 100 years ago, where stars could serve this kind of centering function. Now it almost seems to happen in the reverse way.
And John and Bray was on to say, don't forget Dolly Parton as a good example of the, although she would be an old school wonderful celebrity. She supported, didn't she give $1 million for vaccine research?
She did, and John is completely right, and there are a few exceptions. Dolly Parton singing Vaccine instead of Jolene is clearly one of them. John Krasinski has put together a YouTube web series called Some Good News, which emphasizes the positive in the time of difficulty. Good. Mandy Patinkin, the TV and Broadway star, has these videos that his son has made of him and his wife, but these are really, I think, the exceptions that prove the rule.
And another comment that comes in says, I was a fan of the Kardashians. I loved watching the show, but it changed for me when Kim had her 40th birthday on a private island during COVID. I mean, these are the missteps that people make and take, and suddenly they're, and we're not talking about cancel culture today, but they can be cancelled as so swiftly.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, only a few years ago, during terrible wildfires in California, you know, it became known that the Kardashians were wealthy enough to hire their own private firefighting squad and save their mansions. So it's not as if under COVID we're suddenly aware that the Kardashians are incredibly wealthy.
Yes.
Right? That's not what's changed. But something about this experience, I think, in a time when we would have rhetorically expected a unifying discourse. In fact, now the people who might play that role provoke us and seem to annoy many people. And certainly Kim Kardashian, who's certainly in many ways a master of public relations and marketing, has had a misstep or two, without doubt.
No doubt about it. Well, look, it's been fascinating to look at all of that. I know you're giving an online lecture, a free one, on celebrity and COVID to the Royal Irish Academy next month on May the 4th.
Yes, the Royal Irish Academy Discourse on May 4th.
Wonderful. I'd like to attend that myself. It's RIA.ie for people who want to get involved in that. Professor Diane Negre, thank you for your time this morning. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Likewise. Those who took part in the systematic murder of 6 million Jews in Europe are now over the age of 90, and almost all are frail or sick. My guest this morning describes himself as the only Jew who prays for the good health of Nazis. As the last Nazi hunter tracking down the final surviving Nazis from the Holocaust, Dr. Ephraim Zuroff is in a race against time, but he's committed to the task now as ever. Dr. Zuroff, good morning to the programme. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. It's probably self-explanatory, but in as much as you can, explain the role of a Nazi hunter to us, please.
Well, when people ask me what's my job, I say that I'm one-third detective. That's to find the people, to find the perpetrators. Mm-hmm. One-third historian. That's my real profession. I have a PhD in the history of the Holocaust from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. In other words, to find the evidence, the documents and witnesses, tell the prosecution, build a case. And I'm one-third political lobbyist, which means that I often have to lobby governments where there's insufficient political will to bring these people to justice to do so.
Okay, it's a wonderful interpretation of your job, spec. Over what, 75 years since the end of World War II, you feel, do you not, that it is as important as ever to pursue Nazi war criminals?
Yes, I do. And I can explain that to you.
Thank you.
Very briefly by saying the following. One is that the passage of time in no way diminishes the guilt of the killers. Old age should not afford protection who committed such heinous crimes. We owe it to the victims and their families that an effort is made to hold accountable those people who turned innocent men, women, and children, some of whom were actually older than these Nazis are today, into victims simply because they were categorized as enemies of the Reich. These trials are valuable in terms of the fight against Holocaust denial and Holocaust distortion, and they send a powerful message that if you commit such crimes, even many years later, you might be held accountable. I would also add two additional things. Is that one is that these are the last people on earth who deserve any sympathy because they had absolutely none for their victims. And the last point is I'm often asked whether these people regret or show any remorse or contrition. And I can tell you from my personal experience, at least in the cases that I was very actively involved in, none of them ever expressed any regret and any sorrow or any empathy with the victims. And what I suggest to the people who ask these questions is, you know, the person that you see today being brought to justice is obviously elderly and in good cases somewhat frail, in other cases not in such great shape. But the crimes, when they committed those crimes, they were young people at the height of their physical strength, and they were busy devoting all their energy to the crimes that they committed. So it's not as if they didn't help an old lady cross the street. Mm-hmm. They helped commit murder, or committed murder themselves.
I know you're in Israel, but I detect a strong New York accent there, and I'm wondering, when you were 12 years old, and Adolf Eichmann was being famously tried on television in that Perspex cage or box in the courtroom. Was that the beginning of it for you? Was that the epiphany for you in terms of what would dictate the future of your life?
It is true that the first encounter was when my mother got a hold of me, and she was a blessed memory, very, very calm person. And here she was super excited and said, "Ephraim, you got to see this. Israel caught one of the biggest Nazi war criminals, and they're putting him on trial in Jerusalem." Now, I was living in Brooklyn, New York, and there was television to watch it on TV.
Yeah.
Ironically, in Israel, there was no television at that time.
Really?
And everyone was, you know, glued to their transistors.
Amazing. Can I ask you just briefly about your family there? You mentioned Lithuania. Lithuania had the most shocking statistics with regard to, and I hate even that word when I'm dealing with human beings, but with regard to the Holocaust. Could you give us an indication of just what class of horror was perpetrated against the Jewish people in that country?
There were 220,000 Jews who lived in the area of Lithuania during the Nazi occupation, of whom 212,000 were murdered by the Nazis with very active, widespread, zealous assistance by Lithuanians. And there's an amazing statistic that's very important to remember, which is that there were less than 1,000 Germans in Lithuania during the Nazi occupation. Now, the murders, 90% of the people murdered were murdered by shooting, individually. To carry out the mass murder of such a large number of individuals takes a lot of people. In other words, you need people who are going to arrest the Jews. In other words, first arrest them, then confine them, then take them, find a murder site, prepare the murder site, murder them, cover up the murder site, and then distribute, steal. In other words, they've stolen their property, their valuables, everything, and then they distribute it. And these people were spread out over 220 Jewish communities in Lithuania, and there are 234 mass Holocaust graves. So you begin to understand how many people were required to carry out a horrific project of this sort. And the sad truth is that the Nazis found willing, zealous collaborators. And contrary to what the Lithuanians say, they don't deny that the Holocaust took place. They can't deny it. There are 234 mass graves who prove otherwise. But they've, from the minute that they got independence, they've been attributing the tragedy almost exclusively to the Germans and a few degenerate social outcasts among the Lithuanians. And on my latest book that I wrote, together with Ruta Vanagaita, a Lithuanian author, very popular Lithuanian author, until she wrote this book, when she discovered that her family was involved, we put two pictures, which you see through the letters of the title. The title is Our People, Discovering Lithuania's Hidden Holocaust. So through the words Our People, you see two faces, one of a Jew and one of a Lithuanian. And actually, the picture of the Jew is interesting. It's a picture of a man named Yitzhak Anolik, who represented Lithuania in two Olympics, in 1924 and 1928. And as Ruta said, good enough to represent us in the Olympics, not good enough to live, murdered in the Kaunas or Kovno ghetto during the Holocaust.
It's remarkable. I want to get into the Nazi hunting in a moment, but just as we're on this trajectory here, if you don't mind, Ephraim, the idea of, we know what a Holocaust denial is, obviously, it is what it says, but Holocaust distortion has another menace of its own to it. What countries are engaging in Holocaust distortion as you see it, and to what end?
This phenomenon is prevalent throughout post-communist Eastern Europe.
Right.
Now, there are basically four goals that these countries want to achieve. But before that, allow me just to say a word or two about the whole issue of collaboration with the Nazis.
Okay.
In every country that Nazi Germany occupied and its allies, the Nazis tried to recruit volunteers to help them. And there were three reasons for it. One was an ideological reason and two practical reasons. So the ideological reason was they wanted to show that the local population supported the measures that they're about to take against the quote-unquote enemies of the Reich, primarily Jews, but not only Jews. gypsies, homosexuals, handicapped, mentally ill, chronically ill, communists, etc. Okay, now the two practical goals were the following. The Nazis controlled a landmass from the beaches of Normandy in the west all the way to the gates of Moscow and Leningrad, from Narvik and Trondheim, Norway, in the north to the Greek islands, with the exception of the six neutrals. So the six neutrals were Turkey, Switzerland, Spain, Portugal, Sweden, and Ireland. So with the exception of those countries, and of course the British were fighting against the Nazis, as were the Soviets, the entire area was under Nazi control. So it's a huge area, and they're shorthanded. So every local person who could be enlisted freed a German or Austrian Nazi to go somewhere where they were more needed. And the other problem was that they're about to unleash an unprecedented mass murder operation. They come to a country like Lithuania or Latvia, Estonia, Ukraine. They don't know the language. They don't know the topography. They barely know the geography. And they're going to murder 1.5 million people individually by shooting. Mm-hmm. And how do you carry it out? So obviously they need help now. But the point is this. There was a very significant difference between the nature of collaboration with the Nazis in Eastern Europe as opposed to the rest of the countries. Only in Eastern Europe the collaboration with the Nazis include participation in systematic mass murder. So in other words, the level of criminality, I mean, to do what was done in Western Europe, Belgium, Holland, France, in other words, to define who's a Jew, to deny the Jews their livelihood, make their lives miserable, discriminate against them, and ultimately arrest them and take them to either to the train station or to the harbor, depending on the country. In Norway and in Greece, it was to the harbor. In the other countries, to the train station, but it ended there. In other words, they weren't the ones, the Vichy police were not the ones who murdered the French Jews. Now, I'm not saying that to in any way condone what they did. It's accessory to murder. But the murders themselves were committed in Eastern Europe by someone else. And that someone else was the Nazis, of course, the Einsatzgruppen and the special killing squads and their local helpers. They murdered 1.5 million people in 2 years on a front that stretched from Tallinn, Estonia, in the north, all the way to the Black Sea, Odessa, in Ukraine. That's a front of 1,500 kilometers. And the Einsatzgruppen themselves numbered only several thousand people. So in order to explain how they were able to create or to commit such horrendous crimes of such a large extent, it's the help that they received along the way from the local helpers.
Okay. Okay. Let me ask you about this expression of a Nazi hunter that you defined at the beginning of our conversation. It's now 2021. In the last, say, 10, 20 years, how do you quantify a success?
Okay. Since a perfect success is very hard to achieve, I had to make a scale of success. I had to create a scale for myself, starting with one is to publicly expose the person. And by the way, sometimes that's the most painful thing for these people because in many cases the families have no idea what they did during the war. Two is a government investigation, an official government investigation. Three is an indictment that they're charged, officially charged. Four is a trial. Five is a conviction. Six is a punishment. It's very hard to get to six.
Sure. And, you know, when you look, I'm not going to lie to you. We know much about this through movies and documentaries and books and so on. You're at the coalface chasing these guys down. And we hear about Latin America, certainly in the initial post-war search for Nazis and so forth. In more recent decades, where do you begin?
Believe it or not, one of the ironies of this story and the ironies of history is that within less than a decade after the end of World War II, the Anglo-Saxon democracies, many of them, I'll name them in a minute, which sacrificed so much to defeat the Nazis and save the world from Hitler, had admitted some of the worst of Hitler's henchmen.
Yes.
And gave them a new home. So we're talking about the United States, at least 10,000 Nazi war criminals. Among them, Nazi scientists, engineers, and technicians who worked on the V-2s, the rockets, and that were knowingly brought to the United States. There were a couple of people who were brought to become spies for the Americans behind the Iron Curtain and were supposed to be parachuted back behind the Iron Curtain. That number is not clear exactly how many, at least several dozen, but most of the people slipped in by simply lying on their immigration applications, and the people who were processing these applications weren't fully aware of the important role played by the locals. Because 98% of the Nazi war criminals who emigrated to the United States were not Germans or Austrians. They were Lithuanians, Latvians, Estonians, Ukrainians, Belarusians, Croatians, Poles, Hungarians, Romanians. So, in other words, the five countries that admitted Nazi war criminals, Anglo-Saxon countries, were, of course, the United States, Canada, UK, Australia, and New Zealand. Now, four out of the five decided, in other words, to take legal measures against these people living in those countries. The only country that refused to take legal measures was New Zealand, which is a shame because there were some people we know who were murder squads who arrived there. But the number, I have to say, New Zealand was much less than, say, like the United States. But again, in the United States, as I said, 10,000, that's the estimate. Canada, thousands. UK, hundreds, if not thousands. Same for Australia. And recently, there were revelations, for example, that one of the people who was actively involved in the mass murder of Jews in Belarus in a town called Slonim, a city called Slonim, was actually protected from prosecution, was shielded from prosecution because he worked for MI6.
Oh.
And that was followed like a week ago here by the outrageous revelation that Eichmann's boss in Austria, Franz Josef Huber, head of the Gestapo in Austria, was protected by the Americans and the Germans because he was supposedly valuable to work with agents, with their agents behind the Iron Curtain.
Mm-hmm.
He lived under his own name. I mean, this is like mind-boggling.
Yeah, I mean, John le Carré couldn't have written it, I suppose, when you get into that Cold War intricacies. But what I find extraordinary in some ways, Frame, is there were two people in court for crimes committed during the Holocaust. And I found that extraordinary. In 2021, it's still there, that there are still people accused of these crimes walking among us and sometimes caught.
Well, first of all, that's because of the extension of life expectancy.
Yeah.
In other words, if 76 years after the end of World War II were in 1920, I think the conversation would be very different. But most of the people who committed these crimes are living in countries with good health care, like Germany and Austria. And they're the beneficiaries. I sometimes half-jokingly say, and people without a conscience live longer, less stress. But but I think that's just, you know, some sort of, you know, Nazi hunter humor.
Yeah, you need it, I'd say. I'd say you need a lot of humor.
Definitely. Listen, yeah. I'm telling you, if you don't have a sense of humor, you can't do this job, believe me.
But even in COVID, I know you're chasing somebody. Now, that frustrates your inquiries and...
Right, someone who murdered Jewish babies by smashing their heads with a huge rock.
Oh, right. I didn't realize the...
In the summer of 1941.
Holy smokes.
In the town in Lithuania.
Really?
And, listen, if we have a certain problem with the case because the witness didn't fully identify the person, but we think that there's a serious chance that we have found this person. And just think of the message that it sends. You brutally murdered Jewish babies. We'll look for you even 80 years later.
How do you know it's her? Like, I mean, it's a great question, but, you know, and how do you prove it? Where does the evidence lie, the proof,
okay,
the burden
I'll
of proof?
I'll tell you.
What are the legal?
This is a very interesting case. And again, we go back to Lithuania. In the provincial towns of Lithuania, the murder rate was almost 100%. 99%, 98%, very, very few survivors. And 100,000 Jews lived in those provincial towns. Mm. So a survivor, one of the survivors from Kovno, the Kaunas, the large cities, took it upon himself His name was Lev Konochovsky of blessed memory, and he spent 4 years going from place to place to find the few survivors from the small towns and to record their testimony. Now, one of the important things that he did was to focus on the identity of the local killers, because in many of these towns, it was their neighbors who murdered them. In other words, they weren't sent to death camps to be murdered in gas chambers by some anonymous Germans whom they never knew and had no idea who they were. Mm-hmm. These people saw their murderers face to face, and these are people who they used to see face to face in the marketplace or in other places in the places that they lived. So he had a collection. His collection was 1,684 pages of testimony, all in Yiddish, and there were names of 1,284 Lithuanian perpetrators, 1,121 people who we had no idea about, because there's other sources also about these same places. Mm. But the problem was that he couldn't get his information published as a book. He wanted his collection of testimonies published in its entirety without any changes, without any editing, and no one was willing to do it until 40 years later, 1989, he was finally convinced to give his material to the Yad Vashem archives in Jerusalem.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That's the Israeli National Memorial. Mm. So the minute that material arrived in that archives, I sat down and my father sat down, and my father's language, mother tongue, was Yiddish, even though he was born in America. Anyway, we started going over all the 1,684 pages. We found the 1,284 names, and among them was the following testimony. One of the women who was saved in a town called Rasen in Lithuania, hid in a pile of hay very close to the murder pit. And from there, the testimony says the following. While hiding in the hay, I could see very clearly two women smashing the heads of Jewish babies with a huge boulder, or taking two babies and smashing their heads together. One of them was the student K. Okay, that's the first initial of her last name. Mm. So our problem is that she didn't fully identify her, but we know from the name, first of all, what her status was, and using a technique that I developed for cross-referencing immigration records, refugee records, with Nazi war crimes records, I found two sisters who were the right age with that name who immigrated to an Anglo-Saxon country after the war. And it just so happens that we're doing a research project in that country right now for a different group of criminals. And my researcher was able to find that she wanted to review all the names that had previously been submitted to this country. And she came across that name of Kay, and she started looking for her. And she found her. She found one of them. In other words, this someone who definitely fits the description of the student K, mm-hmm. alive and well, living not far from where she lives.
Remarkable.
Now, so the next step is, of course, to go to this town and interview elderly people who might have known that family and who could tell me what the name of their daughter was, or if they had a daughter. In other words, the ones living in that town. But unfortunately, this town is the COVID capital of Lithuania today. But hopefully soon we'll be able to do that. I just have to hope she's living alone. She's living by herself, so she's in good shape.
She's probably the one person on earth you hope does not get COVID more than anyone else at this point.
For sure. 100%.
When we see footage of 90-year-old, 88-year-old, 99-year-old men or women being brought before the court, there is a thing that you refer to as misplaced sympathy syndrome. Can you
Correct.
Tell me about that?
Okay, in other words, when we see them, when they either try, they usually try to look as frail and sick as possible. In other words, they're trying to convince the public that this is a total waste of time, this is cruel, this is not the way it should be. So, for example, there's two different types. There's one like Demjanjuk, Ivan Demjanjuk, who in his trial in Germany, he acted like a total zombie, like he has no idea what's going on. So no one knows, of course. I mean, very few people are aware of the fact that the minute the legal proceedings, the trial proceedings ended every day, he got up, he walked around, he joked with the people around him, and he knew very well what was going on. So I always used to say, if there was an Academy Award for the best performance by a Nazi war criminal that year, definitely Demjanjuk would have gotten it. There's no question, hands down. Okay? But the point is that when they committed these crimes, they were young people, full of strength and vigor. And that's why they're being brought to justice now. If they had the bad luck to live a long life, well, that's their problem.
My final question to you this morning is, why do you do it?
Listen, I could answer you very simply with three words. I am a Jew. And for me, listen, we can't bring back a single victim of the Holocaust to life. But what we can do is to hold those people responsible for turning them into victims, to bring them to justice. And I think that's the minimum we owe the victims.
Dr. Ephraim Zuroff, thank you for your time this morning. Continue good luck with your ongoing search. It's an extraordinary thing to be doing from a desperate time in civilization's history. And we thank you for your time this morning. Good to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Ephraim Zuroff, who is the chief Nazi hunter of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in California and director of the center's Israel office and Eastern European affairs. And I think we need a breather after that, because that was an absolutely fascinating insight into a world that you would have thought might have been in the dark and distant past, but so it continues and on it goes. We'll be back shortly. The text number 51551. Well, the story that my guests this morning want to share is the incredible true life story of John Cameron. He was a lost child. He spent much of his life trying to find his mother, and in so doing uncovered a scandal that rocked the nation. Sadly, John has dementia, but his wife and his daughter helped him finish piecing this whole story together, and they join us to tell this extraordinary tale. Trasa and Aileen, you're very welcome to the programme, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having us on.
My pleasure. Trasa, if I may, I'd like to start with you, and you might bring us back to when you first met John.
Well, we're 58 years married this year.
Congratulations.
So we met about 60 years ago, I suppose.
Yeah.
But anyway, how that happened was I was still in school, and I had a cracked mudguard on my bike, and it absolutely snapped, and I was thrown over the handlebars, and John was coming the other way on his motorbike. And he carried me, he got me home. And the thing was, John had, he spoke Irish, and my father was from the Ring Gaeltacht, and he spoke, so they spoke, when he brought me back, they spoke in Irish, we all spoke in Irish. And so that was, and my dad just took him to heart straight away.
What a dramatic, beginning to your life together, because he kind of, you fell into his arms, essentially.
I did.
And as your relationship blossomed, he got to know your family well. As you say, your father took a liking to him and what have you. What about your knowledge of his family?
Oh, he spun me a yarn that his father had gone to America, that his mother had died and his father had gone to America and was killed over there. But then we started talking about it in more detail.
And what did you discover?
So then he may be a bit upset sometimes. And I'd say, well, John, he started to tell me then that he was in an orphanage. And I said, well, sir, look at that. That was the start of your life. But look how far you've come. Because he was trained to be a teacher. That's how I met him. He came to Gorey to train as a teacher.
What did you ultimately discover about his early days in Artain?
I just couldn't believe it. Artane was bad, but the foster home was worse. The foster care that he had before and was actually worse than Artane.
Tell me about that.
He was just made to do the jobs that no child should have been asked to do. He was only six, and he had to empty the chamber pots for the foster parents, first and foremost. He was sent out to, and he was made to go out and weed the garden. I mean, not just the garden, a field. The cat used to come into the garden, and the cat came and was laying around. And so then the foster mother's daughter was home from England, and she went out and said, what were you doing? And he said, I was weeding the garden like the ass. No, you weren't. You were playing with that Peckham cat. You know, so it started hitting him around the head. So John ran out, followed the cat out onto the road. And then this lady was waiting at the bus stop. She said, she stopped and said, would you like to tell me why you're crying, young boy? They struck up a friendship and she became his saviour in the heel of the ring.
Tell me about Nell then, Nell Digby French, and her significance.
She was an angel. She was a lady in the true sense of the word. Like, funny thing was, she was Protestant, John was Catholic, you know, and she tried to adopt him a couple of times, but
did she?
Anyway, because she was Protestant and she was a single lady, there wasn't a chance of that happening.
Tell me about the significance of the number 11963.
Well, when he was brought to Artane, you were stripped of your name and you were given a number straight away. And he actually got violently beaten one day because he couldn't remember his name. The Christian Brother was walking up and down through the classroom, I suppose, and with the Bible in one hand and the leg of a chair in the other. And he asked John a question, his number, and he couldn't remember. He was stumbling and stuttering, and so he whacked him with the leg of the chair across the back. He still has the marks on his back to this day.
Did he have, in later years, what we now know is post-traumatic stress disorder from all of that?
Oh, sure. He's still suffering today because, like, I bring him medication right early in the morning, and when I bring it into him, he usually grabs hold of my hand and he'll say, Jasper, just don't let them take me away. Don't let them take me away. Please don't let them take me away.
And how old is John now?
He's 85. He'll be 86 in September.
Isn't it extraordinary how that fear travels down through the decades?
Oh, it's terrible now. It's so sad to see it.
Let me talk to Aileen. And Aileen, you're welcome. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Ryan.
You started helping your dad with research. Tell me, what did your dad want to know? And where do you begin?
That's a good question. It was when we discovered his family that, you know, Dad started to open up about it, and when the details of the Ryan report started to come out, that Dad started to open up a little bit about the story, mm-hmm. and his story. And, you know, it was a slow unravelling of the family background in terms of what led Dad to becoming Boy 11963. So he really wanted to understand his backstory, and also he wanted to know what Artane knew about him. Like, what there were, he never had any. He always claimed that he'd never been to a court room, and to be put in Artane, you had to have a criminal record. And he always claimed that he'd never been to a court, and that he was just literally brought to Artane. So he wanted to find out how he ended up being there, you know, what court case, what criminal record. And what they would have said about Dad was he was a child in alums, was the terminology they used, and that meant that he was begging on the streets. But basically it was a trumped up charge, because it basically Dad was begging from the state out of no fault of his own. He'd no parents to provide for him. And so I got those records from the court. I actually found the original documentation on the day he was brought to court. Well, the court was held, but Dad wasn't in it. So we got that information. And we also got information from Artane archives, which Dad had never seen, which showed how many teeth he'd had extracted, what his what state of health he was in when he arrived in Artane, what medical conditions had happened, things had happened to him over the years of his stay there, and what kind of grades he'd gotten. He was actually quite a bright student. An awful lot of children who come out of Artane actually couldn't read and write, but Dad had very good Irish, he'd very good maths, he'd very good English, and he studied carpentry while he was there. And the one thing that struck us about the documentation from Artane was that they said on his leaving Artane, they wrote a note that he was of good quality. That's so impersonal, and, you know, it's so derogatory. He was of good quality. It's like talking about
a side of beef.
Yes, exactly.
A slab of meat.
Exactly. So we found out all of that, and in actual fact, when he had left Artane, they very discreetly, evidently, because Dad had no idea. They checked on him once a year, so there was reports that they had been out to visit him where he was working and what he was doing. And again, they had said, you know, he's doing well, he's, you know, he's making a life for himself. And so that was his early childhood information that we were able to get.
And he was what age was he when he was in Artane then?
He was, you had to be eight to go into Artane. So you were nursed out, the phrase was nursed out until from, say, 3 until 8. And then once you reached the age of 8, you were sent to Artane or any industrialist school. And then you were there until you were 16. And at 16, you were literally put out of into the world. No supports, no nothing. There was
good luck with that.
Nothing. The jacket on the back of your shoulders, and that was it.
Okay, so 3 to 8 in the foster scenario. Eight to 16 in Artane.
Yeah.
And by all accounts, listening to your mother and in the book, of course, we see a time where deep trauma was inflicted on your father to the point that even today with dementia, he can have lucid moments of fear and panic.
So he had a real fear and a sense of isolation and of being totally adrift and having no path, nowhere to go. You know, he just didn't know basically what to do. And he felt he was suicidal by times, and he says it in the book as well. And again, Nell came to his rescue because he'd been turfed out of the house. The same woman who had beaten him on the day he met Nell had come back from England and had moved back into the house full time. And when she arrived, she kicked Dad out of the house. And so Dad didn't know where he was going to stay. It was like he was been left adrift again. Nobody wanted him. He'd no roots again. And then Nell came to his rescue and helped him get back on his feet and found him digs close by. And so there was many times that Dad would have had breakdowns in his life. And I remember when I was quite young, when Dad was actually studying for his degree, that he was overwhelmed again. But I was very young, and we just knew we weren't going near Dad. Dad needed a rest. Dad needed to be sleeping. Mm. The curtains were closed. Mm. And so we had a sense of that throughout our younger lives. But yeah, no, Dad would have had quite impactful stages in his life where it would have made a negative impact on him.
From the book, there are three men all in one. There's your dad, mm-hmm. there's John Cameron, mm-hmm. husband, and there's boy 11963. And what I'd love you to do, if you could, Aileen, for me, is to try and navigate the very complicated genetic waters here in terms of the provenance of your dad. Your dad clearly spun a yarn to your mother in the early days of their courting and, you know, made up a backstory that didn't come to pass. Where was he from?
That's a very good question. We literally had no idea where he was from, and Dad didn't have any idea where he was from. All through the years, Mum and Dad had been trying to search for his origins. They knew from Artane that he had been born in Enniscorthy, and from the orphanage as well. They eventually found Dad's birth certificate. When he'd gone for his birth certificate originally, it hadn't been lodged. So in actual fact, Dad didn't actually exist because there was no birth certificate for him. And when he was going to marry Mom, they went again to try and find his birth certificate, and they actually found it. And in that process, they also found his godmother. And they had found through her that the names of his parents and that they had come from Longford. Mm-hmm. And so all through the years, they had gone to various churches and various archives to try and track down William and Elizabeth Cameron, which were on the names on his birth certificate. And it always came to a dead end, and it got nowhere. But then in the early 2000s, we got this phone call to say that this lady thought that she was related to Dad. And that had come as a result of the many people that Mum and Dad had spoken to down through the years.
And where did this bring you?
It led us on the most extraordinary path. We could never in our wildest dreams have imagined what was going to unravel as we discovered more of that story.
Yeah.
We discovered that Dad had... He was one of 11 siblings, full siblings and half siblings. And there were five sisters and one brother still living back in when Dad was 1960, when he was 67. And we discovered through them that their parents had been made national newspapers back in the 1930s. What had happened originally was that Dad's mother was married to a guy called Hugh, and he was 20 years older than her, and very shortly after they'd got married, he'd gone off to America. She'd had one child at that stage, and he came back a couple of years later. She had another child, and then he went back off to America. And in the process of him being away, she met William Cameron, who was in the local accountant, and she had some disputes with the land. They had a farm, and they had disputes with the land. And Hugh had said, "Well, go speak to the local accountancy firm and see what you can do." And it was through that very long process that she met William, and they fell in love, and they started an affair, which, as you can imagine, back in small town Ireland in the 1930s, was a huge scandal.
I can only imagine, just about.
The local priests and bishops were sent up to the house to tell her to stop this, you know, this philandering around the place and the shenanigans that was going on. And she was vilified, really, in the local community. She finally fell pregnant with William's child. And so she decided that she was going to try and get Hugh back from America and claim that the baby was his when it was born, and I'm going to say, well, it was a premature baby. And so Hugh was brought back, came back. We don't know what kind of a letter she wrote to him, so obviously he came back and in May, and Una was born in December. And obviously when the child was born, that Una was a full-term baby, and Hugh was having none of it.
So Hugh had a handle on the mathematics, essentially.
Yes, exactly. It didn't take a genius to put two and two together and come up with four.
Hugh had a head for sums. Okay, God help him. Now, where does that leave us?
Well, Ireland back then was a very different place. And if it happened today, we wouldn't bat an eyelid. There'd be no comment. It wouldn't make a difference. When Elizabeth married Hugh, he got title of the farm, which was our family farm. So he had ownership of that. And so she had no rights on the land. She had no rights on anything. And so he put notices out in the Longford newspapers to say that no shop was to give her any credit, that he wasn't paying for her groceries. They weren't, you know, he wasn't going to be financially giving her any support in the local shop. So that led to one thing and another. And then eventually it ended up in the High Courts of Dublin. He decided that he was going to divorce her. Now, it wasn't the divorce that we know today. It was a divorce from bed and board, basically. And so that led to a national scandal where it was written about in the local and national newspapers. And it was one of the first times that DNA testing was used to determine the paternity of a child in Ireland, in Irish courts. She was pregnant on my dad at the time, and so she had no choice but to lie on the courts because she was about to lose everything, you know, and she was shamed by her community. So she had to stand her ground as best she could. And even though she was pregnant on my dad, she said, "No, I didn't have an affair with William. This is Hugh's daughter." But unfortunately, the judge said, well, I suppose in his wisdom, he said, you know, this type of testing is too new. It hasn't been tested enough. And in the court documents that we found, he said, you know, in the future, this will be an amazing tool for people to use, but we can't trust it today. And he sided with Hugh. And so she was left adrift. She was lost everything. And that's when she herself and William moved to Enniscorthy, where my dad was born. Hugh took the farm, and he insisted on taking the children. But then he ended up putting them straight into a home as well. They were put into an orphanage. And Una, the daughter who the court case was about, ended up staying with the grandparents for a number of years. And at the age of 9, both her grandparents were... Her grandfather had died and the grandmother was ill. And so she was taken away into a home. When they were in Enniscorthy, we assumed that his mom had postnatal depression or some form of a breakdown, because she'd gone to confession, and in Enniscorthy the priest said to her, "You have to give up this man and this child if you want to get redemption." And so that's how William Cameron brought my dad to the orphanage in Eccles Street in Dublin. And the last that the godmother saw of my dad was him being wrapped in a little blue blanket on the train station with William, and William saying, "I should only be for a little time, we'll come and get him again." And they never did. They never did. And they got back together 2 years after they left my dad in the orphanage. And they subsequently had four more children together, four daughters. It's a difficult one to reconcile.
It just feels like a remarkable case of classic compartmentalization.
Yes.
That was then. This is now.
Yeah.
And they're in the orphanage. They get on with their lives. We're now we're back together with our four kids.
Yeah.
And again, this isn't judgment. It's merely an assessment of what we're looking at. And so how long did Elizabeth live? When did she die? At what age?
She lived incredibly to the age of 103.
Really?
Yeah. And dad got the phone call 2 weeks after she had passed away. Dad's an incredible man. Like, he never had any bitterness. He always had this need to know where he came from and what were his roots. His only regret was that he never got to hold his mother's hand. And he has no animosity, which I think really is a mark of the man, a measure of the man. He's just so happy that he has his sisters now, and they've been more than open to him. They've welcomed him with open arms. They love him very dearly, and he them. And it's wonderful now that at this stage in his life, he knows the background.
There's a sense of, the word is closure, but there is. Because he wanted to find this information since from whatever age he was. He loves history.
Yeah.
He was a teacher. So he was well equipped to go on this quest.
Yeah. But that determination to educate himself, and he knew that that was a way out of another life. He's a great man who to achieve what he has achieved. And even in Ballyfermot, in the school where he would have taught, he would always say to the lads, you know, stay with the books, do what you can, stay as long as you can, educate yourself, because you'll never get the chance again. He would have had a great understanding of the boys that he would have taught in Ballyfermot as well, and a great empathy towards them. And I think an awful lot of the students would have felt that about Dad.
Well, it's a remarkable story. I hope you pass on our best to your dad.
Thank you.
When you're talking to him again soon. Tressa and Aileen, thank you for talking to us this morning, and we wish you every happiness.
Thank you very much indeed, Ryan.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you both very much. It's Aileen Rogers and Tressa Cameron joining us to talk about Boy 11963, an extraordinary story about the life of John Cameron. It's published by Hachette Ireland. The text number, meanwhile, this morning is 51551. At 9:29, I want to talk to Brian Sinnott. Brian is a counselling therapist at Tig Lynn. Good morning, Brian. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you keeping?
Really good. Thank you. I don't know if you heard the emails and communications before the outbreak about what are we called dry drunks. And I know Tig Lynn, I know well the great work you and your friends and colleagues do there. This is not an expression that would be alien to you. Is there a dictionary definition, Brian?
Yes. It was a term that was created by the creators of the Alcoholics Anonymous 12-step.
Mm.
And their definition is this: the presence of actions and attitudes that categorize the alcoholic prior to recovery. That's their definition in a 1970 book called The Dry Drunk Syndrome.
Right.
Very, well, very good read. So the actions and attitudes are still there. In fact, I would go further and say they're probably magnified. They're worse.
Yeah, flesh that out for me then. So this is somebody who's thinking of giving up the booze, and you're almost like cold turkey. Is that the sort of area we're talking about?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, and it's how you look at addiction is very important. And how we need to look at addiction is that the problem isn't just stop the substance, whether it's alcohol or other illicit drugs, stop the substance and you're fine. Addiction goes as far as physically, but it goes psychologically and even spiritually as well.
Mm.
It permeates, it affects the whole of the human being. And that's why good, thorough treatment is very, very important, not a superficial, just stop the booze.
What we're hearing is the horrible fallout. So if an alcoholic is in a house on their own, they can just damage themselves and the four walls around them. It's this awful side effects it has on humans that they live with that is so damaging. And the difficulty is you'd want a heart of stone not to have some sympathy for the alcoholic also, because they, you know, there's a reason for it too. But if they're a horrible alcoholic, you know the way some people can be almost a benign drunk, if you like. But if you're horrible, if you're vindictive, if you're cruel, if you're physically abusive, you're now living in the tyranny we've talked about before.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so glad you're talking about this, Ryan, because it's a subject that's very close to my heart, because there are many families in Ireland that are living a nightmare because of exactly what you're talking about. And they have someone at home that is in early recovery or in what's called late recovery. They're 20 years off the substance, but they're living in hell. And there's a phrase we often use, and I'm sure your listeners will be aware of it, a street angel and a house devil.
Sure.
And I think we probably all know people like that. I mean, it is quite pervasive in our culture. And there needs to be sympathy and support for the family. I would also argue there needs to be sympathy and support, but not enabling for the person who is off the substance. That actually, great that they're off the substance, but that's only step one. Many people in addiction have told me, hundreds in fact have told me, that getting off the substance is difficult, but that's the easy bit. Going from being sober to sober-minded is the real journey, to coming to a place of calm, coming to a place of rest within yourself, a place of wholeness. That's a completely different journey, really. So to say that someone is off the substance, well, that should be celebrated, but it's only step one. It's only putting the key into the ignition, if you understand what I mean. There's so many other things that need to happen for the journey of recovery to be possible. And or to be productive. Otherwise, everybody else around them is living a nightmare. And what can often happen is someone says, well, I'm off the substance now, or I've been to treatment, so now you owe me. And I am the moral authority in the house now because I've conquered this thing. And it can be just terrible to live with.
Even the language you're using is so menacing. You know, you owe me. I'm in charge. I give up the drink. Now, this is what you wanted, isn't it?
Yeah, and it is. And what often happens, Ryan, is a fascinating but awful thing, is that you can switch from one addiction to the other. So someone gives up, let's say, alcohol, but then they still have this craving psychologically and physiologically. And we forget, Ryan, that things like anger and rage release very powerful addictive substances inside in us.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
That if an addict has an addiction to one thing, the anger can it's almost a replacement.
Yeah, it's a replacement substance, but you have to do something to make it happen. So instead of picking up the bottle, well, you have to get angry, or rage is often a part of this dry drunk syndrome, and a sense of inferiority, but it expresses itself in a superior form. And in a superiority.
So they release it by picking a fight with an innocent party.
With anybody.
With anybody. But they generally tend to do it from what I understand, at home. And then they go outside, and now the angel leaves the front door and the devil is left behind.
Yeah, because anyone who knows anything to do with addiction will know that shame is a huge issue for the person in addiction. So if shame is the huge issue, well, you can't hide at home very easily, but you can hide to your next door neighbours. You can hide to the extended family. And often the dry drunk is the star of the party, is the funny guy in the crowd, is the celebrity in some way in a local dynamic or whatever else it is. And then when they come home, the children and the spouse, they're living a nightmare.
So it's a
terrible conflict for the family because they see, well, everybody else thinks they're great, but, wow, we must be wrong, you know?
Why doesn't the shame travel both ways? In other words, you're suggesting the person will feel ashamed as soon as they step outside the front door, outside the house.
Yes.
Why doesn't the shame follow them back inside, so that when they're horrible to somebody like a wife or a child, why can't they feel ashamed of being so horrible to those innocent people?
Well, familiarity breeds contempt, and you can't keep the front up at home.
Okay.
Everybody knows what we're like at home. We're different when we're at home and we're out. We've social masks on, whatever they may be.
Yeah.
But we are who we are at home. We can't keep an act up at home. That doesn't work.
Not for too long anyway. That's terrifying. And I tell you, it's even more terrifying because people can't leave their house now. So nature in all its cruelty has doubled down on that unpleasantness for people. And unpleasantness being too little a word for too big a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I reckon, Ryan, this is anecdotal, I don't have the figures to back this up, but I reckon that an awful lot of our domestic abuse has to do with this dry drunk syndrome. And the two aspects of it is there's one thing to be said for the guy or the lady who gives up the substance voluntarily, say I'm deciding to give up whatever substance it is, whiskey or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's another thing, another ballgame altogether for someone who doesn't want to give up the substance but can't afford to buy it because they're unemployed. They're a complete nightmare to live with.
Well, what happens to them?
Well, what happens to them is they become enraged.
Yeah.
Because people often don't understand addiction, that it's not just about putting down the bottle. But another word for addiction is dependency. It's a fabulous word to understand it. Because when someone's in true addiction, they would prefer the substance than drawing oxygen. It's about survival. The body speaks to the mind and says, you are not going to survive unless you take whatever substance it is. And it's very, very real. That's the inside mind of someone who's in addiction. So to say, just put down the bottle, that actually isn't the full answer at all. And I think it's the answer that many people give, that the drink is the problem. You mentioned that earlier on. The drink isn't the problem. The drink is the symptom. And it's the symptom of a whole load of emotional baggage.
Yes.
And the taking of the substance is medication. I mean, alcohol is old-fashioned medication. Illicit drugs that you get on the streets, it's medication.
Because, is it the sense that people with issues like this are on the run, and that's from demons?
Yeah. It's an escape. It's always an escape because the pain is too much to face with. And that's why treatment is really important, and good treatment, because there's a lot of group work, there's a lot of acceptance and love and work on identity and all that kind of stuff, which is very, very important. Very thorough, but very possible. If there's anyone stuck in addiction today, it's very, very possible to get out of that, but you can't do it yourself. Not possible to do it yourself.
That's a huge thing to say. You can't do it yourself. And I've seen what you guys do in Tig Lynn up close in my brief encounters with clients and people who work the system there. I work up the system there with Aubrey and friends. And what struck me about it is that everyone who's had an addiction generally has a story, has a soul, and has a heart. Mm-hmm. And to me, watching it at that level, and my dad was a psychiatrist who dealt with a lot of people with addiction problems too, so maybe a bit of it rubbed off me in terms of curiosity on the subject, if nothing else, is that heart and that soul and that story is often reduced so much so that the person's lost sight of reality.
Yeah, that reality is too tough.
Yes.
Reality is too hard. And there's always a few common stories of trauma or rejection or pain or in emptiness. Simple and emptiness, and there can be a myriad of sources, but they all come down to the fact that the human mind or heart, whichever you want to call it, is aching, and unless that's and if you take away the substance that's medicating that ache, well, that ache comes out at home, and that's a nightmare for everybody. That becomes an ache for everybody else. Then
there is the other alcoholic who is a very kind and good person, but as soon as the first drop goes into them, they become monsters.
Yeah.
And the child or the person will be saying, wait, don't, please don't. And then they go, no, I want to, because, it'll be fine. And then, boom, you're into then that awful world until sobriety comes home.
Yeah. I mean, we've used the term as kids sometimes, Dutch courage. And often the quiet person is someone who is suppressed in some ways or locked in fear usually. Mm. But when the substance come in, all those defenses go down. And I wouldn't say the real you, because it's a distorted you comes out, because then the medication, as I'll call it, but it's illicit, it's not prescribed, it's not balanced like your father would have done, comes out in really distorted and very destructive ways for everybody.
As you say, Brian, people can't do it on their own. And what drives me, what makes me concerned about talking about these things on the radio is that we will say Al-Anon, Alcoholics Anonymous, alanon.ie, of course we'll say that, and we'll mention the other helplines and so forth that people go. But I get the sense a lot of people who are in these situations are so beaten down that the mere thought of trying to organise an intervention is too terrifying, or they've just, their hands are thrown up going, this is my lot, I'm out. This is, I just have to face it, because the consequences of trying to put this injured person, the sick person, into the sin bin or whatever you want to call it, to dry out is just too much. You know, it's easy to say you should do this and you should do that and you should escape if it's becoming abusive, but it's never easy.
No, life is really complicated, and there's a thing of codependency that we don't have time to get into today, but also there's sometimes just financial dependency. Mm. You know, I can't leave with the children because I can't eat, I've nowhere to live.
Yeah.
But what you can do, Ryan, is take the first step. And the first step is to make relationships outside that zone. Friends. Whatever about professionals, friends. Friends who are outside of that understanding. Friends often who don't know anything about addiction, because they'll turn to you and to say, this is wacko, we need to get you out of here. We need to form a plan. And sometimes that's a long-term plan.
Yeah.
I know someone that formed a plan for 8 years.
Really?
Lived in an abusive, dry drunk relationship. And for 8 years, they had a plan to get out of the situation. Now, they didn't have children. But that's how complex it can be.
And did they get out?
But they did.
Successfully.
I was talking to her yesterday on the phone.
And how is she?
She's great. Absolutely.
Isn't that good
great.
News?
But needed to put a whole load of distance. And it takes a long time as well to disentangle the lies and the deceit. One of the core issues with addiction, Ryan, as you'll know, is deception.
Mm-hmm.
Self-deception for the addict, but actually deceptive on everybody else as well. It's like living in your own little cult, a family cult.
Yeah. That's a really good way of putting it, because, and with every cult, there's a cult leader and who firmly believes in what he or she is saying is the law.
Yeah, and there's a dependency on the cult leader.
And there is a dependency on the cult leader, because then you realise, or you think, I suppose, I don't think I could function in normal society if he or she wasn't there.
That's right.
And now you're terrified into paralysis.
Yeah, but what I'll say, Ryan, is we live, as much as we complain about our governments and all that kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
we live in one of the richest countries in the world. There is help. There is support. And if I could just throw in Tig Lynn's number there.
Of course, please do, yeah.
0404-400-10. And also 085-158-2112. Jessica in Pierce Street. If you're in trouble and you don't know how to get out, if you need treatment or whatever, those numbers will be a signpost for you to take the next step. And you can have a confidential conversation there and at least get the ball rolling.
Yeah.
All you need to do is start taking the first step. You don't have to get to step number one or number 10. You only have to get to step number one, the next step. And you can do the next step. Without doubt, you can do the next step.
Okay, that's very reassuring. And people should know that with regard to the numbers you give out, very few people to remember or write them down, is that we'll put them on our Facebook page with a link to what you guys do. And I think that'll be very helpful. If you're just joining us, Brian Sinnott is a counselling therapist at Tig Lynn, which helps people to recover from addiction. Brian, a few questions from you on the text, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
My experience as a text is that even when my alcoholic father dried up, we all had to still dance around him, dance around his recovery, his road, his challenges. Meanwhile, a family of seven navigated their young lives and are all now in therapy. This shatters families.
That's right, absolutely. And that's where, the person who's the addict or the alcoholic needs to be informed at some stage. It's not all about you. It's also about us. We do love you. That's important, that we don't treat someone in addiction as, you know, something awful or subhuman or something, although they're behaving like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we can say, you know, we do love you, but we also love ourselves, and we can't tolerate this anymore. We won't tolerate this anymore. Very, very important. Now, how you do that, you need wisdom to do that. But if you find yourself in a family where you're dancing around one figure all the time, it's an abusive, whether it's dry drunk, whether it's addiction, it's abusive, and it's harming everyone else, particularly the children. I remember I'm a therapist, so I talk about people's pasts all the time, and it always goes back to those formative years, you know. And if we could prevent even just one family this morning from entering into that, wouldn't that be fabulous?
Yeah. Oh, you speak wise words, there's no doubt about it. What your guest is saying is really hitting home, says another text. My father is a raging alcoholic and was an absolute tyrant in the house. It took me so long to cut him out of my life, and I know that I still get funny looks when I try to explain myself and what he was like. I can tell that nearly most people don't believe how bad it got, because he's so good at playing people.
Yeah.
This is the house angel, house devil rather, street angel you talked about. I'll do a couple more and you can have a reflection in a moment. My mother was, as you described, says the text, kind when sober, but she was abused as a child and an alcoholic all of her adult life. My lasting memory is, as a child, she'd give me her bottles to dump in a field down the road, and I can still feel the shame as a six-year-old who knew that this was wrong, but who loved their mother. She died aged 60, and it was almost a guilty relief. Another says, I've lived with a woman for 26 years. Good times are great, bad times are torture. She brought her own issues into the marriage that took years to come to the surface. I stayed because I love my family and my two kids. My kids now cannot wait to move out. My wife is the best in the world, but just don't put a drink in her hand. I'm at my wit's end. Just as recently as last night, my son and I had to block the driveway to the house to stop her driving drunk and getting more drink. I fear we can't do anything about it if she won't help herself. Just to say, a woman is just as domineering and cruel as any man. I love my wife and I've cried and stressed over her, but it won't change. This is a tiny insight, Brian, a tiny, tiny straw poll into what's happening in houses around this troubled country. And I mean troubled, obviously, for COVID and mental health. And I know you were saying, and we've been talking about this mental health tsunami, booze or no booze. We talked about it yesterday, that when the shutters are up, there's going to be a lot of damaged people coming out from houses and flats around the country. There is going to be a premium on minding.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And what we need to break, because of our historical reasons here, Ryan, is the shame. This is our secret. This is our family secret. Don't let anybody know. The next door neighbours are not meant to know.
Is that Irish? Or, I mean, would they do this in Scandinavia or Germany? Do they say, you've got a drunk problem, you are drunk and we love you, but get fixed and come back? Or do we have an Irish sense of shame and secrecy that's different?
I've worked in the UK an awful lot and they don't have it to the same extent at all.
And in America, they'll tell you queue for a coffee.
Yeah, no problem. There are shame-based cultures, and I would argue that ours historically is a shame-based culture.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's desperate. Yeah, I'd love to get out of that.
Dreadful. Yeah. Well, how we get out of that is start sharing with one another and stop being paranoid about what people think. You know, people aren't actually thinking about you all the time.
It's so true. It is so true. And actually, I know that I was talking to somebody recently and they were going through the horrors. And I said, it's not as bad as you think it is. You think that everyone's... it's a bit like, and I'm being really silly, but it's a bit like when you have maybe a spot, a zit, or something on your face. You think it's the size of Mount Rushmore, where it's actually... and no one else notices it.
Nobody
but you're walking around going, sorry about it, pointing at saying sorry, like that Irish. But actually, you're grand. So it is... it's just kind of silly thing to be saying, but you do know what I mean. Okay.
Sorry, but you're not that important to everybody.
That's exactly it. And yet you are at that most important level that we're talking about, which is local level, which is home.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm enjoying your discussion about alcoholism. My husband struggled with alcoholism, but my friends really crippled me with judgments. They told me I was stupid for staying. They stopped speaking to me. They punished me for staying. It made a bad situation even worse.
Mm-hmm.
Crikey,
mm-hmm.
That's not great.
No, and we'd need to go into the details
Of course. Could you ask, Brian, about the significance of personality disorder hitherto masked by self-medicating behaviour such as alcoholism, drug addiction, gambling addiction, etc.? I presume, is this something you come across in your...
Oh, yeah, and this is actually where Tiglin is championing at the moment in a thing called dual diagnosis, putting the horse before the cart, which is it? Is it a personality problem, a disorder or whatever, or is it addiction, or is it both? And Tiglin, as far as I'm aware, are leading that in the country. Certainly they're very prominent within that, because it often is the problem. And then when you approach the health services, be it private or public, often it's like, they'll move from one department to another.
Yeah.
So where does it fall down? But what I would say is, again, you have to break things down very simply. And all you got to do is start. Wherever you are, whether you're the dry drunk or the victim of that, mm-hmm. you just need to make the first step. And when you get to the first step, you'll probably figure out what the second step is. But take that first step. Very important.
It's such good advice, Brian. I've enjoyed, if that's the right word, talking to you this morning. But it's refreshing. It's concise. It's clear advice, and it's a healthy conversation. Like you say, the only reason we're going to become a less shame based society is by talking about stuff. Tiglin, TIGLIN.ie, all details there. Brian, it's been great to talk to you. Look forward to seeing you at one of the centres at some point when the fates allow.
Great. Missed you last time with the barbecue. Thank you.
Exactly. Get there again. All right, Brian. Nice talking to you.
God bless you. Thank you.
That's Brian Sinnott, who's counselling therapist at Tiglin. And like he alluded to there, sometimes they have a barbecue in the summertime. So they come up and visit all the clients who stay there. And it gives you great insight into the world. And a very painful world for a lot of people. But even more importantly, a very hopeful world, because there is that hand of friendship out there for you, if only you could have the courage to take it. And if you are going to take that first step, as Brian says, we wish you every success. Good luck. I want to say hello to Ashley Casserly. Good morning, Ashley.
Hi, how are you?
Lovely to talk to you.
Well, I know.
This is a strange one. Okay, so let's. You're in the United States, God bless America, but where were you born and brought up, and where are the folks?
So I was born in Mullingar, actually in Dublin, but from Mullingar, and my family lived near Multifarnham.
And Multifarnham, what part of within Mullingar were you raised in?
Oh, so I'm from Coolnahay. It's in Flaymore, kind of on the road out of Mullingar towards Ballinacarrigy.
And like so many, you got the glorious J1 and got the hell out of here.
Yeah.
What year did you get your J1? Where did you go?
That was in the year 2000, and I went to San Francisco with my friends from college. We were all in Galway, in NUIG.
And what did you get up to over there?
We had a great time. We were in San Francisco. It was amazing. Loved it. Spent the whole summer and then came back, got my degree, and then found another way to get back to America. So came back. That was 20 years ago. So I've been here for a good while. Yeah.
What did you do your degree in terms of what you were armed with when you went back again?
My degree is archaeology and Greek and Roman civilization. so very handy.
I did Greek and Roman as well, by the way. So it is utterly useless and yet wonderfully enriching.
Yes, absolutely.
Strangely, but I don't regret it for a minute. Loved every minute of it. And equally with you, archaeology is great. But you either want to be an archaeologist or you don't.
Yeah, and I think that I was kind of in the don't want to be an archaeologist camp.
Okay, so you went back. Where did you head to?
So went back and actually went to LA and then lived there for a while, then moved back to San Francisco. And basically I got my real estate license in San Francisco and met my husband. And then we headed over to Washington, D.C. We were there for a few years. And then we moved to Miami and then moved to Orlando, where he's originally from. And so we've been living here since about 2012.
And this brings us neatly to zombie house flipping. Now, zombie house flipping, for those who don't know, is a very popular program in America on the Lifetime channel. And you can follow Ashley on her Instagram, Ashley_Casserly, just to get a handle of what we're all talking about here. But before we get into what the program itself is, you were part of this program. When you got the call as a real estate agent to say, we'd like you to be involved in a TV show, what did you think?
This guy called me kind of randomly and was like, hey, we're going to do a show. We're trying to find the right people. It's going to be called Zombie House Flipping. And I was like, oh, this guy is obviously a scammer. I have no idea what he's on about. And it sounded so bizarre, you know. So I was kind of like, yeah, whatever, and hung up. And then he called back about a week later and was like, oh, we're still looking for people to do this show. He was looking at my website and he was kind of like, oh, house number two would be perfect on the show. Do you know any house flippers? And then I kind of thought of my friend Justin. And so I called Justin and I was like, I think this guy, this is a total scam because the shows that he's talking about sound ridiculous. And Justin called him back and 5 seconds later called me and was like, oh, we have a Skype interview tomorrow at 11 a.m. And I was like, oh, my God. And so then we did the Skype interviews and we got two more members in the team. And then they flew to Orlando and we did a sizzle reel for a few days.
So a sizzle reel is like an introductory sort of piece of film to pitch it.
Yeah, basically. And they rented us kind of a cool convertible car and had drones and cameras and it was just so crazy because none of us had done that before, you know. And and then they sold it to A&E and then A&E picked it up and that was 2014, so we've been doing it since then.
Congratulations.
So they just renewed and that's season 4.
So on it go. But so I suppose the key to this now is to tell us what it is, Zombie House Flippers.
Go ahead. Well, basically a zombie is kind of a real estate term back in the day when there was foreclosures because of homes that were left for dead. And so that's where they came up with the term zombie house flipping. And so now every episode we basically renovate a house that's a zombie. So it looks awful. It's been left for dead kind of thing. And we go in and we fix it up. And then at the end there's an open house and we sell it. And so each episode is a different house.
I weirdly, as somebody who loves Home of the Year and Dermot Bannon's programs, Room to Improve and Goodbye House, this program sounds like it's kind of up my street. So because it's all neat in one episode, is it? You take a ruin of a house.
Yeah, one episode.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And there's a lot of shenanigans. It's more entertaining than it is. You don't really learn that much in it, I'd say. It's more funny Florida style living. Alligators, okay. That kind of thing, yeah.
Well, because alligators did feature prominently in one particular episode, did they not?
Yeah, we had an alligator come into the pool. The house was like right across the street from the lake, and it's super common here. And the alligator crawled across the road and got into the pool, and then we had to try and get him out. And Justin was one of the guys on the show, was like throwing him fried chicken and all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Now, what people would be curious to know as well, Ashley, is when you get the house, because you're still a real estate agent, I take it.
Yes.
And this is a sort of a sidebar of a job. Would that be right?
Yeah. I'm a real estate broker, so I have agents that work, my company. And then, and then we flip houses kind of on the side, yeah.
So the,
and then we do the show.
And so the houses that you're flipping, are these physically and literally financially your projects? So you're absolutely viscerally involved.
Yeah, so the show like kind of pays us just to be like to film us, I suppose. But then all the money and us buying the houses, that's all on us. So it's all... So it does get a little bit stressful at times because, Hollywood doesn't really understand how real estate works. And they're kind of like, oh, I thought this house was going to be finished, 3 weeks ago. And you're like, there's planning permission, permits,
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of pressure like that. But yeah, it's all our own money. And then, we would only buy it if it's actually going to make sense for us too. So.
Brilliant. One of your colleagues got in touch with me personally to tell me about you. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Was it Justin or...
No, Keith. He's the builder on the show. Yeah.
Tell him I said thanks, but
he's very jealous that he's not on the radio.
Come on! But he said in the email he said he would love to hear Ashley on the radio and see if she loses her American twang and becomes more Irish in our conversation. Are you one of those people? Do you go more Irish when you call home?
Probably. Yeah. It's very hard. I used to work as a bartender here, and like literally every American is like, "Oh my God, I'm from Ireland too," and you'd have to chat to every single person the whole time. So sometimes I would just be like, using my American twang a little bit more than
to get out of the small talk.
Yeah, because otherwise you're busy, you can't talk to everybody for hours in bed. West of Ireland,
Indeed. And what do your folks make of your newfound fame in zombie house flippers?
I would say they're probably more impressed that I'm on your show than I have a TV show. So. No, they're grand. I think my mum watches it and my dad watches them. Yeah, they're delighted.
And you've got you're married and with kids now over there.
Yeah, I have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, so I've been very, very busy.
You're a busy woman. And how is the American situation between COVID, the new president, relatively new president, and economically and everything? How are you feeling about the world now?
I mean, it's very crazy. It's totally different to what I'm hearing about Ireland. It's in Orlando, especially, the real estate market's it's like on fire, and just seems like the economy is doing very well where we are anyway. And it's kind of you just wear masks and everyone's getting vaccinated now, so everyone feels very positive over here. But nice. I know you guys are having a hard time. I just heard that they lifted the quarantine for anyone who's vaccinated going into Ireland.
Yeah, it's an evolving situation, but I think it's moving in the right direction, which is good news. Certainly the latter half of this week seemed to be more positive than the first half, which is good. I suppose when I look at America, I was reading a piece in the New York Times at the weekend saying that that demand is exceeding supply at the moment, such as the rush from American citizens post-COVID to spend money. I'm hoping this will happen here for the businesses here, that people come out and there'll be this release valve to say, right, give me everything. I want to buy stuff. I want to get the economy booted up again, rebooted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's very positive here. And I mean, the housing market right now, you can't, I mean, there's six multiple offers on every single home practically, you know, that hits the market. So, and it's a lot of, we have a lot of cash buyers coming from, moving from New York, as clients from California right now, DC, Atlanta, they're all, you know they can work remotely. So basically they've kind of decided to live in Florida where it's cheaper living. And so, yeah, our economy here is doing great. So yeah. That's good.
Isn't that intriguing that the pandemic has forced people to rethink how they do business and actually then affects migration within a country because people have learned a lot of lessons from this thing?
Yeah, big time.
Remarkable. Ashley, good to talk to you. And thanks for your time today. Continued success.
Okay, thank you so
all
much.
The best.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
All the best.
Appreciate
Ashley Casserly joining us from the United States of America. And our program is called Zombie House Flipping. Which you can watch. It's on the Lifetime channel. And that is a great old yarn from America. Shall we take a break? We'll take a break.